good to have you all with us. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and wherever you are in the world, I hope you are comfy and ready for some Red Eyes Radio. We are going to spend some time today talking about the Church of Global Warming with our guest James Follett, who joins us from Sydney down in Australia. I hope you had a chance to see his film called just Church of Global Warming. We had it linked up on redicecreations.com. James has been generous enough to link up his whole production for free online via his website, climatereview.net, and of course on his YouTube channel as well then. It's a very well-made documentary that goes into the details of the science and economics as well behind global warming, and examines the claims from both sides of the climate change slash global warming camps, as it were. And we're going to talk about his film and his research a little bit more in detail here on the program today. So with that, welcome to Red Eyes Radio, James. Thank you for joining us today. And I know it's early for you down in Sydney, so we really appreciate you having you, you know.
No problem. Skål, Henrik, and greetings to all your viewers, and hope this will be informative and interesting for you guys. And thank you for having me on your show.
Absolutely. Skål, as I say. Thank you very much. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you came about making this film. I know that you have a background in terms of the energy industry, working for renewable energy companies and things like this. Tell us about it, James.
Well, yes, I have, for a relatively young guy, quite a varied background. Sort of a master of many things, but not really a master at all of any of them at all. And I started off at university, I guess, doing a natural sciences degree. And that I did that at Cambridge, and that's a very awesome degree in that the sense that it's very broad. So many degrees these days, you say, well, I did biology or chemistry or physics. Well, in this degree, and it's set up on purpose to be so, it's very varied. So I did maths, I did chemistry, I did biology. I didn't do so much of the physics, which is, I know, slightly not as irrelevant for climate change, but it did give me a founding and an understanding of how to look at a scientific process and evidence. I really enjoyed it, actually. And by the last year, I specialized in neuroscience, which is a fascinating topic. I really did enjoy that. And so I went to Berlin because I also wanted to learn languages. I was never that good at languages at school, but I always had a fascination because there's always this connection between language and culture. And if you can speak a few words and try to speak a few more words in any place you're visiting, then obviously you're going to get a good reception. And I had German exchanges throughout my schooling, so I thought, well, I'll go to Berlin. The beauty of the European Union in this case is that I was able to get a job by literally one evening thinking, well, I've had enough working for a bank here in London. I need to go out and see a bit of the world. And I just wrote two emails, and both departments, one in, I think it was Heidelberg, and one in Berlin, said, yeah, sure, have a job. And I thought, well, the Heidelberg one is very famous. We're internationally famous, but I thought, well, Berlin is also an amazing city. So I chose Berlin, and I spent 6 months there, and I would have carried on doing that. But there are some complications I heard from people with regards to careers in science, and I was not sure. I was a big umming and ahhing, should I do a career in science? But I think, you know, I would have liked to maybe spend more than the 6 months there, maybe a year or two, but I wasn't sure that perhaps the PhD route was particularly for me. Mm. I had friends who were doing them, you know, at London University and various other universities back home. I say back home because that's one of my homes and a major home. And after that, I got called by my brother for his wedding in Sydney. So I came over for a holiday, and you may perhaps be a backpacker, the usual thing, you know, the Europeans going to Australia and backpack around Thailand and all that. But I've done a lot of that, and you know, I just got a job here, and I never left. I got a job working first for the prisons, which is quite an interesting job. And then after that, I got a job working for a renewable energy company, which of course I can't mention because there's a big conflict of interest of what I've done in this movie and what a renewable energy company would want to see happening in the marketplace. They all know about me doing this, so it's not like I'm doing it behind their back, but of course I just can't mention who it is.
Okay, well, there you go. We can talk a little bit more about renewable energy and how the economic situation has the connection as well here to the whole global warming situation as well. But how was your time in Cambridge, by the way, in terms of science and education there? What was there if I can put it this way, what was the level of indoctrination when it comes to climate change when you took that science course there? Was that an issue at all for you?
Well, for me, I guess climate change only has really come on my radar in the last couple of years. So I was more on the sort of, we did do, you know, proper full-on chemistry and quantum theory and, you know, all these awesome concepts of the universe, which really did go over my head, unfortunately. I wish we understood more. But mostly I was on the biological side. So I was, yeah. So climate change wasn't really on my radar until a personal interest that came later on.
Okay, I see. So why did you want to make the movie? What got you into this whole area? And when did you set up your website and so forth?
Well, it's actually pretty much around when the Great Global Warming Swindle, the movie, but the awesome movie by Martin Durkin, came out. But it's actually just a little bit before. I remember that for some reason there was perhaps a little bit more exposure in the press with regards to, I mean, there's always been exposure for the last 20 years about global warming, been spammed by it, but perhaps there was a slightly elevated in Australia, and I thought, well, actually, this is something we should be concerned about, as both the scientific interest in me perked, and also the fact that the company I work for and the work that I do for them, which is in many ways looking at strategies and looking at portfolios and risk and all this sort of carry on, is very relevant to my company. So I actually said to my boss, can I look into this global warming phenomenon and see some of the science behind it? Because, you know, as you know, I'm a bit of a scientist, so I can perhaps understand some of what these guys are saying and come to our own conclusion. Of course, this is extremely important because the company I work for will make a ton of money from the whole emissions trading. And the market, and we are like a trading sort of company. All these energy companies trade contracts. And if you have perhaps better intelligence than the next player, then you have obviously an advantage in the marketplace. So my boss said, yeah, okay, you can go ahead and look into it. So I went to look into it, completely neutral. I had no opinion either way, no, as far as I think, no preconceptions. And so I went into it, and very rapidly, the first website I got to, actually, obviously the first on the Google hit list was Real Climate, which is a pro website. And so I was reading their stuff, and it to me, it all sounded very convincing. And then as I probed a little bit further, perhaps the skeptic side just started to ram home. And the message was, I kept going back to Real Climate and the New Scientist also website as well. And I think it was Nick Calder was ousted from there, wasn't he? Because he wasn't playing for the right side.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
And I kept going back to these websites and I was thinking, well, where is actually your evidence? I mean, at the end of the day, I'm looking for evidence, you know, and I couldn't find any. So I pretty quickly became skeptical. And by the time the movie, The Great Global Warming Swindle, came out, I was pretty much, you know, listening to it avidly, the message these guys were saying. Yeah, so I can't really remember the transition, but it was pretty quick when I went from, I would say, completely neutral to being skeptic, because I was just looking for evidence and I couldn't see any.
So there's a side note here that maybe we can talk a little bit about right away. Australia have basically a toilet tax, don't they? At least some parts in Australia, I've heard that they've begin to bring this in, and I've heard that one of the issues might be because of water conservation, but it's connected with the carbon tax issue. Do you know anything more about this?
It sounds very Australian. They call it the Dunny tax around here, of course. I haven't heard of the Dunny tax, but water, of course, is a massive issue. You look at the buses on the road, and they're going to have, you know, water efficiency, desalination, dams, you know, all these sort of equals good life, you know, or equals, you know, a bright future or something like that. I haven't heard of the Dunny tax, but yeah, I mean, I think we have water metering, so if you flush the toilet half or full, then you're going to cost yourself more money.
Well, there you go. What are some of the big points then, if we go into that, that the global warming skeptics kind of won you over on in terms of some of the key points that they have brought out, and some of the things that kind of convinced you that this side has a little bit more when it comes to their argumentation, James?
Well, I guess the two most prominent bits of evidence would be the Al Gore graph, which your listeners might well know about, which is 600,000 years or 400,000 years of temperature versus CO2, which he showed in his movie, An Inconvenient Truth. So that was obviously the first debate. And when you hear about the fact that, yes, there is a correlation, but of course, correlation does not mean necessarily causation, because just because two things change in the same way doesn't necessarily mean one's causing the other. Of course, there could be some other factors in between. So there may be maybe a secondary factor. And it also doesn't say who started and who got caused by it. So when you find out that people pretty much unanimously in the scientific field say there's an 800-year lag and that temperature is driving the CO2, and then you also hear that the physical mechanism is extremely well explained, especially it's mostly to do with this, the thermal changes in the ocean and the amount of, you know, carbonic acid in the water, how much CO2 can contain in the water. And this is, you know, a high school student learns. So science makes sense in terms, the actual graph makes sense to what the physical science we know, the observed science. And so that really has been debunked, that whole graph, which was the centerpiece of his movie. So that's like bang. And then, of course, the other huge one is the world famous Michael Mann hockey stick. And I mean, you just look at that and you go, come on. I mean, you see this massive variance noise in his line to the extent that, you know, I do a lot of maths and statistics and, you know, economic modeling. And you just look at the graph and go, you know, I mean, you don't have to even be a McIntyre, who's, of course, a genius, to realize there's something wrong with it. And then my own feeling is there's something wrong with it. And then you listen to people like, you know, McIntyre Climate Audit, who's the guy, I think, was one of the first guys to sort of question the whole thing. And you say, well, these guys are talking sense. We know about the Little Ice Age. We know about Grunewald, the Greenland and all that, and the Vikings and how they appeared and suddenly disappeared. You know, why is there a flat line and why the big jump? Mm-hmm. You know, and so those two things really hit home. And then you go, okay, that's two pieces of evidence. Doesn't necessarily mean that CO2 isn't a climate driver, a forcer, you know, isn't changing the environment. But then you go back to something like realclimate.com or something like that, or one of the pro websites, and you say, well, what have you got to answer for? And well, they try to find some minutiae detail that's wrong or something like that, or claim this or that, the usual sort of science divergence, you know, trying to push you away from the central point. And I'm thinking, well, there isn't really any evidence. You can't back it up apart from your climate models. And I do think, you know, people say, well, you're not a physical scientist. I'm true. I'm acting really as a journalist, but I feel I'm an informed journalist, because they talk about climate models. That's the type of thing I do. I run Monte Carlo simulations. I run market simulations. So when you talk about climate modeling, I may not be trying to model the climate, which was, you know, in some ways quite ridiculous, because it's a chaotic dynamic system, which you hardly model.
Exactly.
I mean, it's a ridiculous concept. You can qualitatively discuss things, but to actually model it, I mean, even in 1,000 years time, we can never, you know, because it's chaos, it's chaotic theory, you can't actually really predict it. I'm sure maybe they will, you know, you can always figure something out, but mathematically they actually say you can't even model it. And all I do often is trying to model the price, just the future price. And we have teams and teams of people who are trying to model one factor, the price, the future price in the market for electricity, for instance, yeah? And we can't do that very well. I mean, we think we can, and we do run the models, and, you know, the law of the land is that you actually have to run these risk models, you know, hence the credit crunch problem when people weren't running these models. But you always have to take it with a pinch of salt. And I'm surrounded by geniuses, you know, mathematical geniuses, and we have trouble doing one variable to, you know, to simulate, whereas they're trying to simulate the whole climate. So you're thinking, well, your evidence is the climate models. If you could give me something else, I will listen. You know, I'm still looking for, if the guys out there who believe in this can show me something, I will listen. You know, I'm quite open to it, but I haven't seen it so far.
So, I mean, if we talk about some of the, because again, we often hear here that there is a consensus among scientists. This is something that Gore and other people are talking about as well. IPCC, we can put into this picture as well. But how do you think that they've managed to get away with this? How have they managed to create such a consensus among people in general about the whole global warming issue, James?
Well, thank you, Henry. Well, the consensus thing, of course, is, you know, it's spurious, and it's been said, you know, Einstein said, you know, 100 people can prove one thing, you only need one person to disprove it, and then it's gone, the theory's gone, you know. Theory of relativity might be broken at some point, or maybe it already has, I don't know. But, you know, consensus is not fact, it's just what we believe is the most likely situation, given the evidence we have. The consensus of the, I don't know, I remember hearing 2,500 top scientists in the news years ago. I don't know, they just say, call it thousands of the top scientists in the world all agree that CO2 is changing our climate, well, forcing a temperature increase at least. And you think, well, okay, and it's really to do with any citation they can get and they can throw it into the IPCC report. So the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change have their reports every 4 or so years, whatever it is. And just because they cite somebody, I mean, they could be citing the most irrelevant thing, may not irrelevant necessarily, but irrelevant to the concept that CO2 is forcing it is. You know, they might be saying that, you know, there are more mosquitoes now on the planet because the planet is warming up or something like that. And they might cite someone's work on it, but it doesn't necessarily mean that person's work is agreeing with them. And when it really comes down to it, there was a great piece, I forgot the guy's name, but I showed it in the movie, by showing the consensus or the cross-referencing between the players in the field. I haven't got his name here. I forgot his name. Mm-hmm. Sorry about that.
No worries.
But he showed that in the important chapter, which is the chapter 9, which is for the policymakers, there's 53 really authors. And all of these guys are, well, I mean, in a scientific field, there's always going to be some cross-referencing between the main players. So I have to admit that. But these guys are all basically peer-reviewing each other's papers. Hmm. And there's only 53. Now, that's actually quite a small number compared to what you see in the media of thousands. And then to counter that side, and you don't hear it in the media, apart from maybe Jim Inhofe, I think he's the American senator, he's got the U.S. Senate Minority Report. And when he shows, and it goes up all the time, we'll start at 4, now it's 5, I think it's up to 800 or 700 or 800 of world-class scientists, all, you know, professors and leaders in their field saying, well, we are skeptical. You know, we are not sure. Some are outright saying it's a load of bunkum, but others are just saying, we are not sure. So how many of those people were included, you know, in the IPCC? Well, some were initially included in the early days and some tried to get out and still were cited as some of the top 1,000 that so-called agree. So there isn't consensus. And the most amazing thing ever is that we still hear this.
Yes.
We still hear that there is some sort of consensus out there. And that, I think, really comes to an interesting point, is why the world's media have continued to say this story when there are so many people out there. I mean, I know initially it was really just sort of the blogosphere, you know, it's some, you know, quacky people out there writing blogs, coming up with this weird idea that the whole thing is perhaps a load of rubbish and that where is your evidence? But the thing is, it's not just those people. There are some of the best scientists in the world. You know, your Lin-Zin Choi, your Spencers and Christies and all these guys are saying that, you know, Tim Ball, which you had an awesome interview, I have to say, I listened to his interview, you just had him on recently.
Yes.
And these people are all saying, and it's not. But they're not really, apart from someone like Lord Monckton, who's perhaps one of the major political figures now in the world, who's going around and traveling around trying to spread the word, they're not really getting a voice. Yeah. I don't think so.
Yeah.
I haven't got cable TV, but I do hear and I do see the YouTube clips that, you know, Fox, which of course is one of the major powers in the media world, is now getting onto it, and which is a great start. But here in Australia, I tell you, it is radio silence. We have a guy here who's... among sort of the small community of people who are interested, you've got Andrew Bolton, you've got Tim Blair, we have a few guys who are excellent journalists and who are writing stuff, but still the prevailing wind is that there is a consensus. There is, life goes on as per before. There is no change. You know, Copenhagen, okay, was disappointing, but, you know, we'll get around that. not the fact that, you know, Copenhagen was perhaps founded on a spurious hypothesis in the first place.
Exactly. And there's so much to talk about there. But if we zoom out a little bit more then and talk about the big picture, that what do you see that this is all about then in the big picture? Is it about media sponsoring this point of view because there's other larger corporations here that have a huge monetary interest in pushing this particular point of view? We can go into cap and trade. We can go into other areas as well. Or what do you see the main reason for this being, James?
Well, there's a... there's different stages to this whole process, it goes back all the way to this phenomenon, you know, like in Gulliver's Travels. You know, Jonathan Swift said, you know, the scientists spend their days trying to extract light from cucumbers. You know, this phenomenon where science can get carried away with itself, and in this case, the politics has just actually even ripped it from the science and made its own bandwagon out of it.
Yeah.
Is something that. It's been throughout history because Jonathan Swift noted this 200 years ago, and this is even before where we had mass media to even, you know, make a propaganda message even stronger. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So this is a very old phenomenon. It'll happen. It's happened for thousands of years, and it'll happen in the future. There's a bandwagon that's occurred, and what can you say is, well, what started the bandwagon? Well, I hinted in my movie that it was largely due to Margaret Thatcher, Maggie Thatcher, the ex-prime minister of Great Britain, also known as the Iron Maiden. And the continuation of it, though, has to be in the days where the money is. You know, they say follow the money and all that. But it is. There's a lot of, it's a huge multi-billion dollar industry behind it. And if you say, where do, what do you mean multi-billion? Well, you know, General Motors has got, have placed their portfolio towards the whole energy trading market coming in, like it has in California, and hence one of the major factors that California is pretty much bankrupt. And a lot of huge industries have to think, you know, where is the world going? General Motors is obviously one of those players that has positioned itself. They're making the turbines, and all that. They don't get the contracts, you know, they can lose big money. But they're just part of the bandwagon. And of course, they got massive political lobbies, and they're going to be saying to the politicians, well, you know, we're not sure about it, but, you know, we're not sure about the science, but this is what the sort of consensus we are told. You know, you can cherry pick what you want to see. And they say, well, the consensus is, because we've been told there is a consensus, is that it's happening. And also, by the way, we have massive amount of jobs linked and money linked. So that's a whole bandwagon. So if you suddenly say, if suddenly someone came out, let's say the Lin Zinchoy paper, which was discussing what they thought they had come to the final, like, proof there had no global warming. Well, there was controversy. So let's say it wasn't proof as yet. But let's say some guy came out and said, look, I can prove there is no global warming. Well, that would be chaos. That would be a complete wind down of policy that has been set in place for the last 20 years. That is, would be a big, bad deal. So there's a big, large, bad deal. But what started it off, I guess, it would be Margaret Thatcher, and it was purely an energy problem on her part. So, and, I mean, she must be, you know, kicking herself or smiling wryly, or I don't know which way you'd be at that point in your life, but she must be thinking, oh my God, what have I set in motion? Have I unleashed Pandora's box here? Because the issue was perhaps started by her, and I can discuss, you know, that issue, why she did it, but then was picked up by the extreme environmentalists. As I say, it's like a Faustian pact. You know, the two sides have decided to get together, and they realized it was a common goal, and so they joined each other. And the environmentalists picked up on it, and environmentalists are absolutely awesome at propaganda, at getting their voice heard, and are quite convincing. So they're quite a strong lobby. And once public opinion goes, I mean, most people I've talked to, they're like, I don't know, I'm told there's global warming, and there probably is, and we all know that pollution is bad, and cars give out CO2, therefore it must be pollution. You know, so it makes sense. You know, it could be make sense, but a lot of people are somewhat skeptical, I think. And even, you know, most people I've talked to, you know, like, would quite believe that it's a load of rubbish if they were proven, shown to them that is the case. They would believe it. But they generally say, yeah, it's probably true. It's probably a problem, and our politicians say it is, so we'll go along with it. So if you have a strong lobby group telling you it is the case, if people are now generally convinced that it is, then the politicians sit where the votes are, you know? The politicians will also go along. If they think that's what people want to hear, and that they want to have solar panels on their roofs, which everyone I know wants to have subsidized solar panels on their roofs, then, you know, which is just absolute waste of funding and money, but it's just votes, then the politicians are going to carry, you know, go along the bandwagon. So you just create this energy, you create this bubble, which has been going on for a long time, and hopefully we'll be able to contract the bubble, you know, softly as people sort of gradually change and don't implement a massive emissions trading beyond what they already have, like in Europe, you know, and then we could perhaps move on to the next world scare, you know, the next millennium bug.
So this is another Y2K scenario we're looking at here pretty much, then. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think there is, I think we all, as you know, as my wife says, we love a bit of drama, you know, and, you know, we all love a bit of excitement in our lives. And if there is this big fear that, you know, the aliens are going to come and get us, or all the computers are going to suddenly stop and the planes are going to fall out of the sky in terms of the Y2K, or, you know, that's kind of exciting and makes news, it sells newspapers, and so it creates a phenomenon. And people like to have that, you know, it's like going to a horror movie. But no one ever really believed that, you know, planes are going to fall out of the sky or anything like that, or the 2012 thing that perhaps, what is it, I haven't really looked into it, but I might do it in one of my next movies. whether the poles are going to switch and therefore all the climate, you know, weather systems are going to go chaotic and all that sort of carry on. Well, no one really believes it'll happen, but it's kind of exciting to hear about, you know. So, yeah, it's part of it, I think. Yeah.
Well, what can you say in terms of, if we look at the politics a little bit more, it seems to me that the political left as well has kind of teamed up here in this situation with the green movements around the world as well. We were in Copenhagen, and we saw in the parades, in the marches there, we saw red banners, socialist banners everywhere. And it seems that the politics has in some way now been connected into the whole question of climate change as well. Is there anything you can say about that?
Yeah, I mean, you did a very good presentation there, and I did watch your videos. And yeah, because kind of strange, actually, it was nothing. There was no exposure apart from one or two midnight or 11 o'clock at night interviews with some pro-CO2 people. We had nothing about Copenhagen here in Australia, I have to say, in my feeling. So it was kind of interesting to see your video there, you being down on the streets and asking just general questions to the guys who are having a good party. I've done all that and stuff myself. I was, you know, running around the streets wearing all the fancy gear, blowing whistles against the criminal justice bill. You know, it's fun, you know. And you get the kids and you say, you know, so have you heard of Climate Gate? It was one of your big questions, I remember. And he was like, what, Climate Gate? I mean, only one or two ever heard of it. Mm. But, I mean, in some ways, I totally agree. You're making a very interesting point, which is, what are you actually here for? You come all the way to Copenhagen, and do you actually know why you're here? Which is a very good point. On the other hand, you know, these guys are just, a lot of them are there for fun. I mean, you know, that sort of thing happens, I guess. But coming back to your real point, which is the politicization. Well, I mean, I haven't looked in depth, I'll say that, but the impression I've got, and it makes sense to me, is that once the wall came down, I've been in Berlin before and after the wall came down, which is pretty awesome. And funnily enough, the wall is still a major feature of the city. It is a city of two halves. It is Ost und West. There is East and West, and they're very different feeling. And the people in the East have something called Ostalgie, which is, you know, like Ostalgie, which is the East nostalgia of the good old halcyon days of communism. Well, we had this big phenomenon in the world, which is, you know, sort of the right and left of politics centered by, exemplified further by East and West. Well, that all disappeared. And so all the people who were perhaps believing that communism is a great idea or not a great idea, well, the left side of politics has something to hold on to. You know, there was communes even in West Berlin and all that sort of carry on. And when all that collapsed, there was not much left. I mean, the world is actually in probably the finest place. Society, the world, civilizations is in the finest place it has ever been in history, most likely. I mean, some people might say we're far better off in little tribes and we're lived peacefully and walked around, you know, as maybe as Neanderthal man. But in the day, it sounds very nice, but everyone was dying from disease and child, you know, birth death rate would have been about 80%. And, you know, we are actually in a very fine place in life. Two of the biggest populations in the world are catching up at a phenomenal rate, of course, India and China. And so their living standard, yes, they have problems, of course, and we can't just, you know, look at Beijing and say that's China. You know, China is a large agrarian society and there's a lot of peasants who've got a long way to go. But basically, the world has been relatively stable and people's lives have been getting better. So the left side of politics, what have they got to complain about? They need something. They need something to grab onto, to hold onto. And the whole we are destroying our planet with CO2 is an awesome, you know, topic. So they switched from, you know, the East-West debate and whether communism was perhaps a better lifestyle, and they grabbed onto the CO2. And it's the same debate, really, which is industrialization is bad, and let's go back to bivouacs.
Yeah, yeah. So exactly, because that's one of my questions here for you as well. If the green agenda basically is connected with this idea of stopping industrialization as well, then, because if we, some points that were raised by some of the people that we talked to in Copenhagen as well, was that if the carbon reducing laws or restrictions are indeed put in place, this potentially could cause millions of deaths around the world, specifically those in the developing countries. What can you say about that, James?
Well, absolutely. I mean, this whole biofuels thing, you know, I get to the petrol pump and I see the 10% ethanol, you know, and I go, oh my God, you know, it's just, one of the worst things that possibly could happen. It's destabilized the sugar industry around the world. You see, a lot of people, you know, in places, let's say in Brazil and that, you know, they're having to burn down the rainforest for two things. One, for food, and the other is for just creating more plantations of sugarcane. And what's happening is that we're destroying, the ironic thing is, a policy that's meant to prevent CO2 production is leading to more CO2 production and to grief, because we're destroying the rainforest, and we're also increasing the price of food, therefore local people can't afford their own food that they're selling, and they're starving.
Yes.
And we're actually creating more CO2 from this policy, so it's a really counterproductive policy. I haven't kept on the latest state of play, and maybe the green credits thing has changed, but as far as I knew, you got green credits for planting, not necessarily for destroying the rainforest in the first place. So as long as those companies were planting trees, the fact that they destroyed some in the process, it still gave them a green credit, you know, so I don't know. You got to be wary of these policies, you know, there's a lot of rorting, as I like saying in Australia. There's a lot of, you know, bureaucracy where people are just playing the money, and it's not really creating a benefit.
I see. And, you know, if we carry on from that and talk a little bit about the, you know, the new green economy as well, then cap and trade and things like that. You mentioned that your company would potentially be one of these companies that would make a lot of money because of this. And do you think that's one of the main reasons here as well, then? Because some people would argue that indeed causing mass starvation around the planet, causing even more problems, is actually part of the plan from the point of view of the global elite and so forth. Don't know if you want to comment on that or not, but the new green economy. Maybe you can talk about that as well. Go ahead, James.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Henrik. You touched on a very conspiratorial topic at the end there about especially a one world government. I'm sure we'll end up talking about that. I've tried to not be too cynical and propound that idea too much, but what we could perhaps talk about as well.
Yes.
Cap and trade, yeah. Cap and trade, I mean, it's a tax. I mean, they say, oh, it's not a tax. No, it is a tax. And, I talked to a lawyer, and he says, the definition of tax and law is different. Well, you know, it's the same thing. It really is. It's just another mechanism. Now, if you talk to my economist friends, they say you could have a carbon tax, which would be, I guess, say to your listeners, you know, just a flat rate that whenever you burn a certain amount of CO2 and they think they can measure it. I mean, of course, they can't always, but they can sometimes measure. We're going to tax you. We're going to add that to the cost of that product. The petrol will go up by 10% and et cetera. But the other mechanism proposed is cap and trade. And it is a tax, as I said, but the economists say it is better because it's extremely complex. Basically, it's a more efficient way of getting your goal. Because for some people, some commodities are worth a lot of money. So let's say petrol is worth a lot of money. So people will be willing to use petrol because the profit at the end is greater. They have a larger margin. So some people will be willing to use more, you know, let's say to buy more CO2. And other people in the market, well, the margin is quite small, and they would actually prefer to reduce their production of CO2 because that's the best way for them to save money. So it's a form of market efficiency whereby different industries have quotas and the inefficient industries will subsidize the efficient. There's a market forcing to make people more efficient, which is the principle is all there, and that's not disagreed. But in the day, it is a massive tax, and any mechanism, any form of mechanism on a industry will hamper it. I mean, there's always this huge great debate on market forces versus regulation. Now, we have to have some regulation, of course, because yes, and you know, I won't, of course it doesn't happen in our company, but yes, we will try to play the field and monopolize and to, you know, monopolize any situation to our benefit. So yes, business people are generally, you know, good people, but they will take an opportunity which may be a bit gray area and maybe not the best for the people if we can. So yes, we do need to have some control. I absolutely agree that there should be regulation. The big question, of course, is the balance between government regulation and difference between government regulation and government control. And that's the problem. See, there's one thing regulating a market, and there's one actually controlling the market. And I think that's where this whole cap and trade is leading us to, is about control. What we're saying is with this cap and trade, it's a massive tax, and It's complete market mechanism. It is controlling the market in a massive way. So it really is perhaps the more left view of life, which is that, you know, business cannot be trusted and that a benevolent, you know, dictator is the way forward. Well, I agree. If we could have a benevolent dictator, the system will work best. For instance, one of the big debates in the energy field, and this is a debate which is really ubiquitous, it's really something that happens anywhere in business, is whether we should have a single government entity, you know, controlling electricity, you know, a nationalized industry or a free market. Well, if we had some supercomputer with, you know, artificial intelligence out there, which can say, okay, this power station is, its chimney stack is out of order. They call it, you know, they call it an outage. We will therefore ramp up the energy in this power station to cover it. Mm. And if everything was perfect, a perfect computer program and everything was like that, then it would be the best way. We can call that the benevolent dictator type thing. Mm. But in reality, we're talking about a bureaucracy. And bureaucracies never work efficiently like that. We have just found, and the reason why communism with its 100% employment rate collapsed. If you say, here's your job, you have your job, whatever you do, it's not going to work because you haven't got motivation. Everyone needs to have a modus operandi in life, you know. Mm-hmm. And so bureaucracies tend to be like that. There tend to be jobs for life. And we do need bureaucracies, and they are extremely important. We need them as regulators. And without them, the market will actually end up collapsing as well. But to say that the whole thing should be run by one bureaucracy, I have one nationalized electricity industry, it can work, and we did survive for a long time. For instance, Australia only, I'd say, in 98 actually deregulated, mm-hmm. but it is more efficient now. But that is a big debate, you know, control versus, you know, independent thought, competition, of course.
And it's all, again, just from the perspective that you're coming in. If you're talking about efficiency of society, then you're into another realm. But if you're talking about happy human beings, then you're coming from another point of view in regards to that discussion.
Absolutely. Well, many perhaps on the left side of politics will say that you are happier without the competition, because competition is stress. And yes, that is also true. But then that's why we hopefully have many forms of job in life. You know, you don't have to be some, you know, businessman who's fighting against other businesses for this electricity and for big profits and all that. And perhaps you don't want to have stress in life, but then other people do live off stress, and what they do is often extremely efficient for society and beneficial for all of us.
Yes. And one thing that you brought up there, I think it's very good, that basically the idea that we lack so many different technologies and advanced systems, intelligent systems that can read the situation and you know, consequently react or act right away depending on what is happening inside the system. But moving on from that thought, do you think that there's something positive then that can come out of all of this in terms of you know, taxations and all the costs that this will mean for companies and maybe even individuals? Because for instance, then, if we have the implementation of new technologies as an outcome of this, then that potentially is a good thing. And I'm not talking about only like windmills and solar panels here. I'm talking about fuel cell technology, maybe even zero point energy or cold fusion, something like this, for instance. What do you think, James?
Well, yes. I mean, we all want to develop, and we all would like to have a more efficient, cheaper, greener, when I say green, less impact on the environment in general. Technologies, and they are being invested in. You know, many billions a year is invested into nuclear power, and obviously cold fusion would be, once cold fusion occurs, then mankind will be essentially sorted because we have unlimited cheap energy. Star Trekkers out there will know what I'm talking about. These things are happening. People are investing in them. There is a motivation for business. And business, you know, big business, energy businesses do have a lot of money, or can have a lot of money, not always, but and they will invest in these technologies if they think there's going to be a benefit. On top of the fact that, you know, governments can still, you know, give funding to physics projects that are involved in nuclear fusion and all that. So there is some government intervention and aiding in the process. That is all we all agree with. Development is the way to go, and is fascinating, and is where mankind is going to improve their lot for all of us. However, doing it through a cap and trade scheme, which is based on extremely dubious science, and such a massive scheme of taxation, which is actually making our system more inefficient, Why is inefficiency bad? Well, it means that businesses are not working as well. That means they won't be able to employ as many people. Mm. They won't be providing as many jobs. They won't be providing their electricity cheaply. Cheap electricity is the foundation of modern society. Australia is one of the wealthiest per capita countries in the world because we have some of the cheapest coal in the world. These are important factors. Africa will not be able to get out of its development. People will not be able to get out of their rondavels, you know, out of their huts, and stop using wood every day for their cooking unless they can say, right, you have a coal power station down the road, which is what they can have if we allowed them, have a coal power station, and you can have electricity. And that, you know, so by putting taxation onto an industry, you are hampering it.
Mm.
So I agree, we need to fund. There should be funding from the big pot of taxes as a whole on the system, which we have. There should be, I mean, and when companies do well, by the way, they pay corporate tax, you know, whatever it may be, 30% or what, depending on whatever country you're in, there's a corporate tax. So like there is already taxation on large companies. Don't forget that.
Yes.
So by making them successful, they will be paying more tax. But don't put on a tax, in my opinion, that is actually hampering their efficiency. You're actually shooting yourself in the foot.
Yeah, exactly. And you see, here is where the other conspiratorial point of view comes in, then, that some people will claim that this actually is the plan. It's not just stupidity in terms of inefficiency and actually, you know, strangling things, but when they think that they're doing something good and so forth, but it actually is part of the plan. What can you say about that?
Well, yes, that really does come to a very controversial argument. Does this extreme left side of the politics, by the way, I'm not left or right. I mean, I happen to be talking against the left all the time, but that's just the way of the nature of the conversation.
Right.
I just sit wherever I feel the right opinion is on a point is a particular situation. But in this, the extreme left view is that really there should be a one world government, and that perhaps even more extreme, that industry as a whole, modernization is a bad thing. And you know what? It's not a completely whack idea. There is some foundation to it. I mean, I would disagree with it myself. I do think there is one problem with our society, and I've said it to my friends over the years, which is the lack of tribalism. Now, that is what really makes people belong. We need to feel, every person on this planet needs to feel they belong to something. And in modern society, we are this big, amorphous blob of millions of people in a city. And in many ways, we're individuals. Now, we have our immediate family, you know, and we have our job or our school, and we may play sports. So there is some sort of tribes there. So there is some mechanisms where we are a community. But it's not nearly the same as what I talk to in, let's say, East Berlin, which is what they have this nostalgia, you know, this nostalgia for the past. Well, what is the nostalgia for the past? Because if you're lucky and you were high up in the Communist Party, you might be given a trabant, you know, the trabi, which is a bit of a joke. You know, I mean, they didn't have any real consumer goods unless you're pretty high up in the party. But why aren't they looking to the past? You know, and this is the reason why perhaps the far left, or we should say the communist or the far left side, are saying, well, you know, we should go to this less developed situation, is because they had community. And they say that to this day, you know, 20 years after the wall falls down, they're still saying, you know, the communes of the past, which was based in Berlin, like they have in Berlin these terrace housing everywhere, five-story high terrace housing. They have these quadrangles. So every group of flats is based on a quadrangle. And pretty much every Sunday, people are invited, half expected to turn up and have a barbecue in the quadrangle. For just come and go, maybe have a beer, but to socialize with your people around you. So it had that real commune feel. And perhaps we need a bit more of that in life. I actually do. I've always said one of my dreams if I was a multimillionaire would be to set up a commune where everyone could have their own personal space, their own flat, but then have, let's say, a wraparound balcony where you can all go out and have a barbecue together if you feel like, or have your personal space, because we like our personal space. But there's some validity there. But pulling back society and pulling back our medical advances and, you know, the disease that we've overcome and the better lifestyles and the less work we have to do because we have washing machines and other devices and vacuum cleaners to do it for us, well, that's probably not a good thing. We want to go away from that as well. But there's checks and balances in life.
Absolutely. And you know, it's a very interesting point. But at the same time, I also must say that what I saw down in Copenhagen was very much tribalism. You know, in that sense, it's people
Absolutely.
People are rallying around this cause. And in one point of view, even your film can be a little bit maybe interpreted from that point of view, that what is developing here, what we can see developing, is this church, as meaning, again, a religious almost approach to mm-hmm. global warming yeah. and, if you will, then earth worship, if we want to look at it that way. The new religion here that's coming forward is the church of global warming, right, James?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, I thought of the church of global warming, and then you look into, then obviously a lot of other people have coined that concept. Mm. Church is strong, but it is strong because it's when a way of life and an ideology really becomes, it's not just a thought out, well, you know, I go to work because I should go to work, and, you know, it brings the money home and all that, and it's a good thing to do. I mean, it's something responsible to. I do it and I have no idea why. You know, it turns into an absolute article of faith. You know, yes. It's no longer a rational decision. Well, the original, there was a rational decision to join the Church of Global Warming. But as you went around Copenhagen, you're asking all the young guys and girls there, all dressed up in awesome outfits, you know, what is ClimateGate or why are you here? They're like, I'm not really sure, but we are saving the planet. You know, so it's like, you know, one of the Ten Commandments, save the planet. But as for the logic behind it, it's not so well known.
That's absolutely right. James, I want to round things up here for the first segment and continue talking more with you here in our second one, specifically going into some of the details about ClimateGate and what you see, where you see things are going in terms of this. There's so much more to talk about. But please mention your website again then for us, the title of your film, and again, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, people can go there, check it out for free, of course. It's linked up on your website.
Very good. Well, yeah, thank you, Henrik. It's my website, which I was very lucky to get at this late stage of the game, was www.climatereview.net, climatereview.net. The movie's called The Church of Global Warming, and you can see that on YouTube, on my channel, or download the whole movie from my website. So, yeah, hope you enjoy it.
Absolutely. Very good. Stay with us, James. Again, the website is climatereview.net, and we'll be back with more after this break. Okay, that's our first hour with James Follett. Join us now for hour two in our member section as we continue to discuss surface temperature stations. We talk tree rings, the influence of the sun, cosmic rays, cloud formation, and weather manipulation. We also talk about CO2 being classified a pollutant by the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency over in the States. What is this all about? We talk more about new technology and the huge amount of money going into development on computer models. Is this money well spent? We're going to round things up talking about environmental problems and the emergence of a one world government, and also how the European Union is being developed, or have been developing, the legal framework for this future world government. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Much more coming up after this break.